In the first hour of the show today, we will look back to the American economy in the 1990s. And our guest for the program is the man who was, for a time during the Clinton administration, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. His name is Joseph Stiglitz. He is the winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics. He was a member and then chairman of the council from 93 until 1997. And then he served as senior vice president and chief economist of the World Bank from 1997 to the year 2000. He has written a book that's just out now that's titled The Roaring 90s, the subtitle A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's out now in the bookstores if you want to look at it. And of course, here on the program, as we talk, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. Anyone's welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Joseph Stiglitz, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Good, thank you.
Good. Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. I think that when the Clinton administration came into office, they set out a kind of economic policy, or at least they had this ambition to craft a policy that would take a kind of a middle position between the kind of economic thinking that we most characteristically associate with Republicans, and that basically means as little regulation as possible and an economy free from government involvement. And on the other hand, the Democratic position, which says, no, some government involvement is important, and in fact, that also we're concerned about things like economic equity. So the Clinton administration said, we think that there's actually some place in the middle between these two. And I think by the time the administration finished, a lot of people said it had leaned way too far in the direction of free economy, the sort of Republican pole. Do you believe that, in fact, it is possible for there to be that middle ground?
Oh, definitely. I think there is a middle ground. In some sense, we're always in a middle ground between these extremes, and the difficulty is to try to find the right place in the middle. My book in the Roaring 90s, what I try to argue is that we agree with what you just said at the end, that in fact we had gone a little too far on the free market position and too little in underinvestment in the public sector. It's not just a question of regulation, it's a broader issue of the role of the state. Let me give you an example. The boom of the 90s was underlying that boom was technology. Underlying that technology was basic research that the federal government had financed and supported. The Internet was probably the most important, but also the advances in biomedical sciences. Underlying this technological advances are basic research that goes on in government labs in our universities, which require large expenditures, not large by some recent expenditures like in the war in Iraq, but large by traditional standards. The point is that we underemphasized that, and we were living during the 90s off the fruits of previous investments, but we weren't reinvesting at a level that would provide, that would ensure that in the future the same level of technological advances will continue to occur.
In 1994, obviously, President Clinton had a great difficulty because the control of the Congress passed to the Republican Party. And
so exactly.
That put a lot of limitations on what he was able to do. But having said that, given that is true, are there other things that you think caused this sort of lean to the right, so to speak, in favor of that kind of economic thinking?
Yes, I mean, I think the fact that he was constrained by the Republican Congress was absolutely essential in understanding what went on. But in addition, within the administration, there were some I would say legitimate differences in perspectives, and I think that the Republican Congress had the effect of pushing the compromises within the administration more towards the conservative side. Let me give you two or three examples that illustrate what I have in mind. One example had to do, that I talk about it quite extensively in my book, Roaring 90s, had to do with accounting. There are these very serious problems that Enron and corporate scandals more recently have highlighted about how do you deal with the stock options that are granted to the executives, the CEO, and other executives of corporations. In the way that they were treated in most accounts, it was very difficult to tell what was going on. It was very difficult for ordinary investors to tell that their shareholdings were being diluted by these grants of stock options. And there was not adequate recognition of the fact that once you gave these stock options to executives, they had an incentive to blow up earnings, to distort information, because they made more money by getting stock value up, by distorting the information, than the coming up with a good project, which is, you know, obviously quite difficult. So we were very concerned about this, and the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which is supposedly the independent board that sets the standards, was also concerned, and there was a proposal for reform. It should have gone ahead. We strongly, at the Council of Economic Advisors, strongly supported this reform, but the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. Department of Commerce, under pressure from Wall Street that was making lots of money off of these deals, and some businesses that were making lots of money, the CEOs more particularly making lots of money, they said, no, we can't change this. If people only knew what was going on, share prices would fall, and we don't want that to happen. Of course, I thought that was an argument for the reform. If they only knew, it would bring down the share price. But they thought it was an argument against. Well, that was an example. They won, and the administration came down on the side against good accounting standards, against reform. We should have had the regulations going the other way, and we didn't.
Some people, I think, have also argued that maybe one way to get at this issue would be to pass some kind of rule about how long, if you're a manager of a company and you have stock in that company, pass some kind of rule about how long you must hold that stock.
That's right. That's another reform going in the right direction, because then you're going away from the short-term, myopic, you know, focus to saying what's good for the company in the long run. And it's that short-term focus that was so destructive. But that's only one example. Let me give you another example where we had the same kind of conflict. One of the banks in the United States, there have been problems after that came to light after the great the bubble of the Roaring 20s and the Great Depression, passed a law that said that investment banks and commercial banks had to be separate. It's called the Glass-Steagall Act. The commercial and investment banks in the 90s saw new opportunities for making profits, and they said, let us get together. The Council of Economic Advisors again said that, no, this is opening up new opportunities for conflicts of interest. There are already plenty of opportunities for conflicts of interest, and this is just going to make our problems worse. U.S. Treasury, reflecting the interest of their constituency, the bank, said, oh, trust us, we're going to create Chinese walls and make sure that there aren't these conflicts of interest. We said, nonsense, you're going to climb over or climb under these Chinese walls. And that's precisely what happened. They were made out of paper, and you got, as evident in the case of Enron, these conflicts of interest really undermined the way our economy worked and undermined corporate governance and made our economy work less efficiently than it otherwise would. So that's another example where the conflicts between the special interests and we might call the traditional values of the Democratic Party came in conflict. Another example where that came out very strongly is we had a very big debate over corporate welfare. Very sensitive. We were very sensitive to this issue because we were under enormous pressure to reform welfare, and I think that was right to reform welfare. But we were cutting back on assistance to the poorest people in our country, and it only makes sense that if we were going to be cutting back assistance on the poorest people in our country, we want to also cut back on our subsidies to our richest corporations. And again, some of the special interests said, no, you know, that's anti-business to even use the word corporate welfare. Pretty evident that when you're giving, you know, billions of dollars to large agricultural agribusiness, that is corporate welfare. And of course, all of these problems have gotten much, much worse under the last 3 years. But again, we had this conflict, and we did, unregrettably, relatively little. We did a little, but relatively little about it. But at least it didn't get worse. The last 3 years, it's gotten much, much worse.
I should introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in the last 5 minutes or so. We're talking this morning with Joseph Stiglitz. He was a member and was then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. This was in the Clinton administration. This was between 1993 and 1997. After that, he went to work for the World Bank, where he was senior vice president and chief economist between 97 and 2000. He also won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001. He's the author of a book that's titled The Roaring 90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. It's published by W.W. Norton and is out now if you want to look at it. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You argue in the book, and not to anybody's surprise, that the economic boom of the 90s that we saw was a classic bubble with all the classic signs, including vastly overpriced, overvalued stocks. Was this though indeed real? I mean, was there real economic growth?
Oh, there was real economic growth. Underlying the bubble were real technological innovations like the internet. And no matter what the government would have done, those technological advances would have let loose a kind of exuberance, some people might say irrational exuberance. My complaint that I raised in the book, Roaring 90s, is that we did a number of things to feed this frenzy. We made it worse, and because we made it worse, when it burst, the consequences were all the worse.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and let us do that now. They are in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
I sort of have a question about the present economic situation, in that I don't understand why the government is touting high productivity, because it seems like high productivity would lead to low job creation and high unemployment, and the figures that came out Friday support that. I mean, I don't see any creativity in creating new areas of work which would lead to job creation, so that if we stay with our same economic situation as far as the type of jobs we're doing, why should we be promoting high productivity?
Well, that's a good question. Let me say, when the economy is managed well, and quite frankly, it's not been managed well for the last 3 years, when it's managed well, what high productivity means is that living standards go up. It means that there's more output per unit of work, and that means if you work 30 hours, your salary will go up by 5%, 10%, and that's obviously good. Everybody wants their salary to go up. The problem is that when you don't manage the economy well, what you said is precisely correct. What happens is that instead of raising living standards, you just create more unemployment, and that's precisely what has happened. And the problem, I think, has not been fully appreciated. We need to create something over 1 million jobs every year for the new entrants into the labor force. In other words, we have to run to stand still. We should have created over the last 3 years somewhere between 3 and 4 million jobs. In fact, close to 3 million jobs were destroyed. So we have a jobs deficit of 6 million. And it's great to have increased productivity, but only if that increased productivity gets translated into increased opportunity, which means new jobs which are high productivity. And unfortunately, the way the administration ran its tax cuts, ran its macroeconomic policy, did not do that. And it was predictably so. I said this in May of 2001, that the way they were designing their tax cuts would not stimulate the economy, would not create the jobs that was needed. And unfortunately, what I said at that time proved right. And I try to explain this in my book, The Roaring Nineties.
Well, do you think there's a possibility that they will eliminate the payroll tax at any point?
No. The problem is that they've made a couple of very bad mistakes. If you go back 2 years, 3 years now almost, we had a 2% surplus of our GDP. We could have used that surplus to stimulate the economy, to provide investments in technology, education, infrastructure that would lay the foundations of long-term economic growth and create new jobs. Instead, what we did is to have a tax cut, a couple of tax cuts, for the wealthiest of Americans, Americans who had done so well over the previous three decades. The result of that is we've changed our 2% surplus into a close to 5% deficit, and some people are expecting a deficit rising to 7% of GDP. Now, the problem is with that kind of deficit, it imperils our long-term economic growth. And that means there is very little room for a payroll tax cut that would actually help stimulate the economy and create new jobs. So under the current administration, I don't see any serious consideration given to repealing the tax cuts for the rich and doing something about the payroll tax. It would be one of the things that hopefully a new administration that is more committed to jobs and less committed to helping the very well-off Americans would look at that very carefully.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay. Then if the situation remains the way it is with high unemployment or longer times between jobs, do you think that would lead perhaps to a move to detach the health system or the health insurance system from being tied to employment? Because I don't see how it can continue to be attached with and leave so many people without health care coverage.
Well, you put your finger on again, one of the very serious problems, a problem that's gotten worse in the last few years. The number of people who are uninsured do not have health care insurance. And obviously, since we have this very peculiar, we're one of the few countries in the world that have this system, where to get health insurance, your health insurance is linked to your employment. It means that if the unemployment rate goes up, you're really in a difficult, difficult situation, and your family's in a difficult situation. I think that there needs to be some concern. Something has to be done about it, and there are a couple different proposals that are on the table. One that was seriously considered in the Clinton administration, and sadly, we didn't do anything about it, mainly because of our excessive focus on deficit reduction. We didn't think we had enough money. Is that the government provide health care insurance with your unemployment insurance? And if you were unemployed for an extended period of time, they would continue to cover you under a special health care program for the unemployed. That would be one thing. The other one is the more fundamental reform that you suggested, that is to say, de-link health care from employment. The problem is that raises a host of political issues where attempts to reform our healthcare system have repeatedly run into opposition from those who are making so much money from the way our current system is run. And I'm not very sanguine about that kind of comprehensive reform. I think it's needed, but I think in the short run, I would put more of my attention to try to doing something about the people who are now falling between the cracks.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Just for a second, if I might ask you to talk a little bit more about the issue of deficits, because you said that you thought perhaps you put too much energy, too much importance on reducing the deficit, perhaps because when President Clinton was running for election first time around, it was a big issue. And certainly Ross Perot helped make that a big issue, and a lot of people were talking about deficits are very important, and for that reason, that's the number one thing that you have to do for the economy is to reduce the deficit. How should we think about deficits?
Well, I think there are two distinctions that you want to make. The first question is the short run versus the long run. When the economy is in a recession or in a downturn, as we are now, where we are underperforming our potential by an enormous amount, then it is important to stimulate the economy. And a moderate deficit can help do that. Deficit spending, tax cuts, and expenditure increases can help stimulate the economy. So that's the short run, and there, that's a traditional recipe. The long run is rather different, and the problem that we were focusing on during the Clinton administration was the fact that since 1980, we had been running very large deficits, 3, 4, 5, 6% of GDP. When Clinton took office, it was 5% of GDP. And if that continues, of course, the country is getting increasingly in debt. There was a concern, and that was right, to do something to try to reduce it. The irony, of course, there are two ironies of what happened. Right now, after Clinton did succeed in getting the deficit down from 5% into a surplus of 2%, and then in a few months' time, Bush reversed that, as I point out in my book, In Roaring 90s, reversed that, and that 2% surplus is now again 5% deficit and looking like it's going to get even larger. So all the work that we did evaporated very, very quickly. And, of course, that gives us a certain sense of frustration for all the work that went in for 8 years to be undone so quickly. The double irony was that the Republicans at the time tried to pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution that would have precluded the kinds of deficits that we have today. So they argued at the time that we should never allow the government to have a deficit. We thought that in the Clinton administration was going too far. That when you have a recession, you should be able to have a moderate deficit. But the problem is that the Bush administration has now had deficits that provide very little stimulus to the economy, but are long run deficits now. When it looks at the long run, the question is, in part, what are you doing with the money? And this is, again, where I think the Clinton administration pushed deficit reduction too far. Any business borrows. Almost most businesses borrow. They borrow to buy equipment, to buy machines. It's very hard to run a business without some debt. And the government, it makes sense for it to borrow if it's going to build roads or invest in infrastructure, invest in technology. These are long-term investments that pay off over the long term. And if the cost of deficit reduction is a sacrifice in these vital investments, then it is actually bad for the economy. And that's the sense in which I think we push deficit reduction too far. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is that the Bush administration generated these huge deficits not by investing in technology, not by investing in education, but by giving a tax cut to very wealthy Americans, many of whom are investing their money abroad, overseas, not helping strengthen the American economy, but helping strengthen their own pocketbooks.
And again, our guest this morning is Joseph Stiglitz. He's an economist. He won the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics and also served as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. This was in the Clinton administration. We do have several callers, and we want to get right back to people who are listening. And our next person is in Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I hope that investing in infrastructure of communications going ahead all right. That was not even 2 minutes, so but I won't waste any more time on that. I wanted to call about broader issues in the sense of the Clinton administration came in with Gore talking about a carbon tax and putting, you know, the eco in economics, realizing it's the same eco as in ecology and working towards some kind of ecological sense of economics, but I don't know if you're wanting to talk about that since it is such a broader overarching thing, but you've been saying the name of the book over and over, Roaring 90s. It begs the question, if those were the Roaring 90s, you know, what's the next decade from our American history? We know what happened next. So is that part of your conclusion or cautionary tale?
Yes. One of the reasons I perhaps was deliberately a little bit too evocative. Obviously, the Roaring Twenties led to the Great Depression. The Roaring Nineties led to there was this bubble. When it broke, the economy went into recession. It is, by some accounts, one of the worst recessions we've had in the last 70 years. Not as bad as the one in the beginning of the Reagan administration, but probably the worst since. Apart from that, since the Great Depression. And you can clearly trace the same kinds of pattern of euphoria, abuses, leading to distorted prices, leading to distorted investment, leading to overinvestment, leading to the crash. So that, in fact, there is a clear link. Having said that, I should be clear. There is we are not nowhere in a serious downturn as the Great Depression. I'm not very optimistic about the strength of the recovery. There are signs that things are recovering, but there are very few signs that it's going to be a robust recovery. And certainly, the numbers on jobs that just came out were not very reassuring. And even during the period of the third quarter, where growth was quite robust, the number of hours worked actually went down by close to 1%. The other issue, let me just pick up the other issue that you raised, which is the environmental issues. One of the points that I raise in the book is that you need to get this right balance between the role of the government and the role of the markets. And markets simply by themselves do not pay adequate attention to the environment. Absolutely, no doubt about that. And this is one of the areas where there is an important role for government regulation, for government action. And it was something that I very strongly supported. And it was one of the areas where the Clinton administration did make an effort, but in which the unfortunately the Republican Congress opposed almost everything that we tried to do. But even in this area, it's very interesting to see the conflict within the Clinton administration. I, as an economist, had the view that the carbon tax would be actually good for our economy, that it makes a lot more sense to tax things that are bad, pollution, than tax things that are good, like savings and work. And so that shifting more of our taxes towards a carbon tax or encouraging recycling made an awful lot of sense. The U.S. Treasury, reflecting much more the business interest, resisted the Kyoto Protocol, resisted Clinton agreeing to the Kyoto Protocol, and trying to scare people to think that it would be terrible for our economy. As opposed to recognizing that would be overall good for our society, including for our economy. So that illustrates the kind of divisions that went on even within the Clinton administration.
Well, we haven't even had a real thorough discussion of the Kyoto Protocol. I mean, I think that we need to do something to go in that direction, but the whole idea of basing it on a speculative trading and, you know, the whole, I don't know how you summarize that's how we're working with other acid rain and sulfur dioxide. It's sort of making a market-based solution rather than a more direct regulatory solution, it seems to me, that that's just making another market game. I don't know if that's even clear enough. Maybe you can explain it better.
Sure. There are a number of different approaches to trying to deal with the problem of greenhouse gases, which are resulting in very clear scientific evidence that resulting in global warming. One of them entails restrictions on quantitative restrictions on the amounts of emissions. The other would entail some proposals involve tradable permits, where you have a permit, but you can buy and sell those permits. Still another set of approaches involve carbon tax, where you actually tax the emissions to try to discourage them. It turns out, I think, that the differences among those three are less important than actually having one of those systems in place. And the problem is right now that we don't have any one of the three. I was much more inclined to the approach that the Clinton administration tried in the beginning, which is the carbon tax, than either the tradable permits or the system of direct regulations. But as I said, to me, that's a second-order discussion. Far more important is that we do something about these greenhouse gases, which are becoming a disaster for our atmosphere.
I want to thank the last caller. We got some other people who are waiting, so we'll go on to Urbana next, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I've got two questions, one having to do with productivity and the other one with agriculture. And the first one is I just can't believe the way you economists talk about higher productivity being so great. You say that it'll increase wages, but what actually happens is that it might increase the wages for the employees that are left after one in five, say, are shown the door and become unemployed. So how higher productivity in one industry, or even if you want, even just a company, you know, is going to create a job for that person you sent out the door doesn't make any sense to me. And yet almost every economist I've ever heard on any talk show or anywhere else continues to talk about this. It seems like, so what are you talking about? Are you talking about the market, the free market somehow magically creates another job someplace else for this person? Or are you talking about the government?
Well, what is required is what we call macroeconomic management. If the economy is run overall with the right, what we call monetary policy, fiscal policy, the overall framework, then the private sector will create the jobs. And we saw that in the 90s, for all the criticism that I level against it. The fact is that we were able to get the unemployment rate down to 3.8%. At the same time, the rate of productivity increased threefold from what it had been during the 70s and 80s. So that's an example of when things work well. And in the many areas of the country, many of the skill areas, unemployment rate got down even to 2%, which is really almost a rock bottom, which you can imagine it. So I think the answer is that it requires both the private sector, but also requires good macro management on the part of the government. And that's precisely what has been so poor recently.
I would agree with that, but just a parting shot on this one issue, and that's that a lot of people would have said that those service jobs that you created were low paying and they weren't really living wage.
We actually, when I was at the Council of Economic Advisors, we looked into that because that was clearly a source of concern. It turned out that yes, there were some service sector jobs of the kind you described, but on average, a lot of the service sector jobs were in financial services, in IT services, and were actually high paid. In fact, the average pay of the service jobs that were being created, or the kinds of service jobs that are being created, you can't identify precisely what jobs are being created, but the kinds of service jobs that were created were actually above average wages.
Hmm.
So, yes, I mean, I think the concern that we not only that we create jobs, but that we create jobs that are high paid is a legitimate concern. And again, when things are being well managed, then that will work out.
Well, geez, that's a very sanguine
optimistic
approach, I think. I've got a question about agriculture, and I know that that, for example, Adam Smith thought that agriculture was of prime value to a country, and that you yourself believe in land reform. And a lot of things are going on in Brazil in terms of land reform. But I heard a characterization of what's going on, you know, in international trade, that on one of the really key issues for those people who are against globalization, and that is that what's really going on is the U.S. and the EU are have way too much, you know, capacity because of all their subsidies. They've got, you know, these falsely high prices, and it's encouraging investment where people should be disinvesting. And it's killing all these third world agricultural industries. And I was wondering if you had any news on that issue, whether things are breaking at all, or, you know, could you give us a little bit on that?
Sure.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. That is one of the issues I actually do discuss in my book, Roaring 90s. One of the things I emphasize is that with the end of the Cold War, America had the opportunity, I would say even the responsibility, to try to create a new global economic order based on our values and principles. And what happened, it was hijacked by some special interests, financial, commercial interests, and among those special interests is agriculture. So what happened is that we went into the developing countries, told them to get rid of their subsidies, open up their markets to our goods, but we did not reciprocate. And it's not only we in the United States, but also Europe and Japan. And so what has happened is there is this extremely unfair global trading regime. The subsidies to agriculture in the United States encourage American farmers to produce more. As they produce more, prices fall, hurting those in the poorest countries of the world. So we didn't mean to hurt them, but that is the consequence. An example of that is cotton. About 25,000 very well-off American farmers share between $3 and $4 billion of subsidies. And as they do that, they so depress the price of cotton that it does enormous harm to subsistence farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. 10 million farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are pushed even below the subsistence level. The damage that we here in America do to these poor African farmers is greater than our foreign aid. And just to be fair on all this, Europe is equally bad. The average cow in Europe gets a subsidy of $2 a day. That number has a certain resonance because $2 a day is the standard the World Bank uses for poverty. So to put close to 2 billion people live below $2 a day. To put it another way, that it's better to be a cow in Europe than just to be a human in much of the developing world. There is no way that they can compete against the United States and Europe with these enormous subsidies. And that is precisely why there is so much resentment.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show, less actually, and we have several callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. And the time that remains, I just should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Joseph Stiglitz. He was member and then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1993 to 1997. This was in the Clinton administration. And he was the winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics. We'll go next to a caller in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Hello. I was wondering, and you addressed this a little bit in the caller you just spoke with, but I was wondering if you could define for us, or for me especially, the term corporate welfare, and give me some concrete examples of how this has been carried out. Like, I mean, you said subsidies to individual farmers in the United States and in Europe, but the term corporate welfare, what do you mean by that? And when you say especially that the Bush administration has increased this a lot in the last 3 years, And if you could give some examples, maybe from agriculture, I would really appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure.
All right. Thanks
sure.
for calling.
The concept of corporate welfare, which I do discuss in my book, Roaring 90s, is simply the notion of subsidies to corporations, just like, you know, helping so-called corporations in need. Of course, they aren't usually really in need, but they claim to be in need. And the subsidies, the help, the welfare can take a variety of forms. It can be a tax break. It could be a direct subsidy. It can be a protection through the tariff. Tariffs. Let me give you some recent examples under the Bush administration. Agricultural subsidies, mainly going to large corporate farms, increased more than double to an estimated $190 billion over the next 10 years. We had agreed, at least people thought we had agreed, to reduce our agricultural subsidies during the last round of trade negotiations. Instead, we doubled them, and that engendered enormous resentment. Another example of a corporate welfare was the protection that we gave to the steel industry, which allowed them to raise their prices, protect them from foreign competition, increase their profits. That was declared to be illegal by the WTO, and clearly was obvious to anybody who looked at them that we were violating international law when we imposed that. And now we've rescinded that because of a ruling that we had, in fact, violated international law. The Bush had violated international law. A third example is that we give subsidies to companies to export goods through our tax system. Again, that's a violation of international law, trying to create a level playing field, make it fair competition. And again, there was a ruling by the WTO saying that we were in violation of international law and ordering us to rescind that. And we have not yet done it, and Europe is now threatening to retaliate. There are dozens of other examples. Let me give you just one more example. When you take an airplane between any two cities, there are landing fees that the aircraft pays and that you pay effectively in your ticket. But corporate jets are not really paying their share of the cost of running the air traffic control system. They're not paying their fair share of the landing fees. And so we are, in effect, subsidizing corporate jets, the magnitude of somewhere between $1 and $3 billion a year. And again, the rest of the American taxpayers are picking up the cost, or people who travel in ordinary jets have to pay the cost so that the corporate jets be benefited.
We'll try to get one more call here, at least in Belgium, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'd like your guest to address the topic of how these recoveries that we've had over the last 10 years, essentially, have been so inequitable across the nation. Rural America doesn't seem to see very much of this recoveries. Rust Belt America doesn't see very much of it. But Indianapolis seems to see tons of it. Deals with pharmaceuticals, I'm sure. If you could address that, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Well, one of the most difficult issues in a changing economy is that different parts of the economy are impacted by new events, impacted by trade, by new technology, and that inevitably is going to cause stresses in certain places and booms in others. And it's one of the consequences, one of the benefits of being a large economy. It averages out. But when some part of the economy is in a boom, another part can actually be quite weak. There's relatively little that can be done about it directly, other than to recognize this and for the federal government to take a role in helping those that are having difficulties. This was a problem that went way back when President Kennedy tried to do something about, and Johnson tried to do something about Appalachia. But
at various times when the defense industry scaled down, California, Southern California was weak. At the same time, when the boom in the new technologies really boosted Silicon Valley and Oregon and Microsoft in Washington State. So this is inevitably part of life. In fact, one of the wonderful things about the American economy, when it's working well, when it's not doing that right now, when it's working well, is that a lot of places are able to make the transition. And so that even a state where there is a decline in some areas will have compensating growth in other areas. State of Oregon, for instance, the lumber industry is in decline, but there are a lot of new industries coming in, including tourism, which is taking up a lot of the slack. Old lumber towns are becoming tourist places. So it is one of the strengths of our economy when it's managed well. And one of the points I emphasize in the book Roaring '90s, that requires a certain role for government. It can't happen by itself. It doesn't happen by itself. And one of the problems is that under the mantra of minimizing the role of government, there hasn't been as the active role as we could have done for addressing some of these concerns.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there with more that could be said, but we're just at the end of the time. Mr. Stiglitz, we want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Our guest, Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. That was during the Clinton administration. And again, if you're interested in reading his book, it is titled The Roaring '90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. It's published by W.W. Norton.